I'll be speaking today on a sort of, I guess you could call it a kind of ruminative topic where I don't necessarily have a clear thesis, but I'm going to discuss sort of what I see as the state of the religious landscape in the United States, and particularly sort of a kind of tripartite division in American religious and metaphysical worldviews that I think might be helpful in explaining sort of what's going on in American life generally. It has implications for politics, social life, the life of our churches, and so on. So that's what I'm going to try and do, and I'll do that for about 30 minutes or so, and then you can raise questions that will probably be more incisive than my own points. I was trying to figure out a good way into this topic before this afternoon, and I think I'm going to use a interesting blog post that was written, I think, yesterday or the day before by a somewhat prolific blogger in the Bay Area named Scott Alexander, who a few of you may have read, who writes about social science, all kinds of various issues from a sort of rationalist, contrarian perspective. And he was writing about the phenomenon of the new atheism that was big about 10 or 15 years ago, was embodied by figures like the late Christopher Hitchens, Richard Dawkins, Daniel Dennett, Sam Harris, and others, slightly more obscure voices. And what he was wondering was, why is the new atheism sort of considered kind of intellectually déclassé among liberals and on the political left? And he said that, you know, when he sort of trolls the internet and reads people talking about the new atheists, there's always this sense of people saying, well, you know, who are these guys? You know, even though I might agree with them, they're just sort of saying the obvious and shouting the obvious over and over again, and it's really kind of boring and pointless in various ways. And Alexander was sort of puzzled by this, and he said, well, yes, okay, a lot of what the new atheists say is just sort of preaching to the choir and telling people who already don't believe in God that God doesn't exist, but isn't almost everything that happens online and in political argument just that sort of preaching to the choir? People who hate Hillary Clinton telling other people who hate Hillary Clinton that Hillary Clinton is terrible. People who hate Donald Trump telling other people who hate Donald Trump that he's awful. And especially within sort of liberalism and progressivism, you know, much of the dialogue is people saying racism is bad to people who already agree that racism is bad. So why, you know, why among all these different strands of sort of progressive thought are the new atheists, the critics of organized religion, sort of singled out as being annoying, irritating, and slightly pointless? And I think that Alexander is right in certain ways, that sort of the new atheism had a moment in American intellectual debate and intellectual life that has passed. I think there are several different reasons for why it passed, but I think one of the reasons is that there are just fewer Americans within the confines of sort of the educated elite to whom the claim that obviously God doesn't exist actually constitutes preaching to the choir, and that in fact atheism, even in a heavily secularized in certain ways society, remains an opinion that has rather fewer true adherents than you might expect, and that in fact a sort of the hardest form of secularism, the sort of, you know, you read Richard Dawkins, you slam down the book and you say, well, that's put paid to metaphysics and the supernatural forever. That kind of atheism is a still distinct minority, even within the ranks of people who consider themselves guided by reason and sort of science and so forth in all things. And so the reason that the new atheists were sort of, you know, have a greater degree of unpopularity, you might say, among the people you would expect to agree with them, is that many of the people you would expect to agree with them on a fundamental level actually don't. And in fact, the worldview of the people who we think of as the most secular Americans is better described in a different way. And I'll try and describe it here as sort of the first of my three groupings within the American religious and metaphysical landscape, which is to say that most of the people who we think of as secular elites, the kind of people who attend fine institutions like this one, the kind of people who I may occasionally work with at the New York Times, are better described as sort of secular but spiritual, meaning that they are people who hold a sort of basic commitment to something that they think of as enlightenment values. They give a basic priority to what they think of as sort of science and scientific reasoning in all things, and they're deeply skeptical of the idea of a person, a personal God, of a specific revelation, be it Christian or anything else. They're skeptical of sort of the supernatural in its more flagrant and miraculous forms. So they're skeptical of a lot of the things that go into institutional religion and traditional religion in the Western world and indeed around the world. But at the same time, they are not what you might call hard atheists. And in fact, they're sort of perpetually on the market in a certain way for spiritual ideas. I think it's useful to think of our sort of secular elite, our liberal intelligentsia, as in a sense having left Christianity behind while shopping for some new religious picture that would enable them to integrate their commitment to sort of science and the scientific method, their commitment to enlightenment values as they understand them, their commitment especially now to the sexual revolution and a sort of permissive view of human sexual morality. They want to integrate all of that with the possibility of some sort of spiritual experience, some sort of numinous encounter, some sort of potentially ordered grounding for the universe that isn't personal, isn't Yahweh of the Old Testament, isn't Jesus of Nazareth, but is not either the sort of hardest form of Darwinian materialism, you might say. And so you see this sort of, you know, if you spend a lot of time with these kind of people, which I do in many ways, I think you see this in lots of different ways. You see it in the fascination, for instance, with yoga and Buddhism and Eastern forms of spirituality, where again and again, Robert Wright, who's a very fine writer on matters political and scientific and moral, has just written a book called Why Buddhism is True. And in that book, he doesn't argue that a lot of the theological content of Buddhism as it's practiced in Tibet and other places around Asia is true. Rather, he argues that the meditative practices of Buddhism fit in various ways with sort of, or enable us in certain ways to break out of the kind of beings that we've evolved to be and achieve a higher level of contentment, happiness, morality, and so on. And I think what Wright is doing in that book is similar to what a lot of sort of, in theory, secular Americans are looking for. They're looking for a way to sort of integrate pieces of religious traditions into a secular worldview in a way that enables them to have a sort of therapeutic use for religion in everyday life, enables them to be a happier and better person, and also enables them to have a kind of integrated view of the universe that's more moralistic and also more hopeful than you get from the sort of hardest and most reductive analyses of, say, a Daniel Dennett or other writers like that. And I don't think that any of this sort of shopping around has condensed into something you could call a particular worldview. But I would say that overall, when I look at what we think of as the secular elite in America, they are trending towards pantheism in certain ways. And this is, you know, for those who read all of Alexis de Tocqueville in college, which wasn't me, but I read, you know, excerpts and so on, as people do. Tocqueville talks a lot about how democratic societies tend towards pantheism for various reasons. And some of those reasons apply as I remember them, and some of them maybe don't apply quite as well. But either way, I think he was right on the specific point, that there is a sort of vision of the universe as a kind of cosmic mind that might be the theological destination for a certain kind of person who, again, would be sort of broadly defined as secular today. And that sort of directionality allows for forms of religious practice and attempts to link cosmology to morality and politics that don't require virgin births, resurrections, and a personal God who answers all of your specific prayers. In this vision, instead, religion and religious practice is about a kind of integration between the personal and the cosmic that allows you to be a better person, allows you to be a better parent and have a happier life, and is connected in some as yet undefined way to the basic morality, the basic moral vision of liberalism. And anyway, I'm not sure how it all fits together, and it may not actually be ultimately trending in that direction, but that's sort of where I see a big swath of especially sort of well-educated, liberal, professional American society today. And I should add that there's also a zeal, I think, for sort of integrating pieces of pieces of religious belief and practice from other religious traditions generally, where the sort of the liberal mind is very comfortable with the Christianity of the African American spiritual, for instance, because it seems to be connected to a sort of arc of liberal social justice in American history rather than being connected to Christian dogma per se. So there's still a certain desire to pull and pluck from the sort of social gospel tradition within Christianity. That hasn't been left behind entirely. But it coexists, I think, with this sort of broader pantheistic trend. So that's one of the three worldviews that I'm trying to identify here. The second worldview is the closest thing to a religious center that I think American life has right now. And it's a worldview that is, you could say, sort of a kind of Christian individualism would be one way to put it. I haven't come up with a perfectly precise definition. But the best way to think about it is, in part, in contrast with what I've just described as the worldview of a lot of secular liberals, which is to say that it's a worldview that is still comfortable with the idea of a personal God, still comfortable with the idea of a God who answers prayers, and still comfortable with the idea of sort of the supernatural in various forms, extending well beyond Jewish and Christian traditions to encompass, again, the sort of more explicitly supernatural style of the New Age movement and so on. And it encompasses a lot of different political persuasions, too. You have people who are Republican voters who read Joel Osteen, and you have people who are Democratic voters who read and watch Oprah Winfrey, and they're ending up in somewhat different places politically. But ultimately, what they have in common is a kind of a faith in a divinity that is engaged in human affairs, that is personal and can have, indeed, multiple personalities, hence the fascination with angels, crystals, New Age healing, shamanic healing. You can sort of run through the range of different supernatural expressions that people get into. But ultimately is something that has to be assessed at the individual level in a sort of direct encounter between God and the self, or in a sort of quest for what some of these writers and authorities would call the God within. So this is you can call it a tradition because it goes deep in American history in its own way back to Emerson and earlier. But it's a perspective that is basically, it's an idea where the self is the, it goes all the way back to Protestantism, this being the 500th anniversary of all that. But the self is, God is real, God is personal, God cares about human life. The self is the ultimate arbiter of what God wants for human life. And I think most of what we think of as sort of apolitical religion in the U.S., you don't ultimately think of sort of Joel Osteen and his style of Christianity as political in the way that the religious right is political. You don't yet, we'll see what happens in the next election cycle, think of Oprah primarily as a political figure. You don't think of Eat, Pray, Love and Elizabeth Gilbert and that kind of sort of religious questing bestseller as political. And that's why it's useful to think about it as a kind of center. It's not a place necessarily where the religious culture war is taking place. It's a place that sort of can encompass more liberal and conservative political visions, because individualism can lead you in a lot of different directions depending on the individual. But it's sort of the heart of American religious faith today. And it's the worldview, I think, that has really effectively taken the place of mainline Protestantism as sort of the central religious strand in American life. So if you went back 50 or 60 years, you would say, you know, you would find plenty of evidence of this religious perspective in America in the 1950s, you know, with sort of Norman Vincent Peale and the Power of Positive Thinking being the kind of emblematic example that people tend to remember. But you had, but it was in competition, in a sense, with a sort of institutional center in American religious life, embodied still by traditional Protestant denominations, with Roman Catholicism sort of coming closer to the center than it had before. And that, I think, is what's gone away over the last 50 or 60 years. So the big story of American religion in the last 50 or 60 years is the displacement of that old institutional, still fairly doctrinally conservative Christian core with this new purely individualistic Christian core. It's the final victory of Emerson over his Protestant critics, or something. You know, you could play it out in different ways. But that's sort of where the center really lies right now. And then you have the third group, which the best shorthand is just to call them religious traditionalists, because you need the designation to encompass a lot of different religious traditions. But basically what unites the traditionalists is the view that there's a personal God who cares about humanity and intervenes in human affairs and so on. That's that they have in common with the religious center, but they believe and continue to believe in the idea of a meaningful and powerful religious authority outside the self. And that religious authority can, you know, varies with the religious tradition. It's different in Orthodox Judaism than it is in conservative Protestantism. It's, you know, in Catholicism it's the magisterium, and in Calvinism it's scripture itself. For Mormons, it's the Quorum of the 12 Apostles, and so on. Each tradition will have a different definition of authority, which is why it's not always meaningful to talk about sort of traditionalists as a unified group in any way, shape, or form. But relative to the other two groups, they are unified in this view of an authority extrinsic to the self that takes the form of a holy scripture or some sort of ecclesiastical authority that can make binding rulings on matters of theology, matters of personal morality, and so on, that you are supposed to try and conform yourself and your own religious journey to. So that's sort of my attempt at dividing all of American religious life into three parts, with the really hardcore atheists often removed, shaking their fists at everybody. And I think thinking about it this way is helpful for explaining, in certain ways, some of the shifts back and forth that you get in what we think of as the American culture wars, which up until recently were primarily defined by sort of growing religious difference. I think lately, in the age of Trump, they've become more defined by race and ethnicity and identity politics, but the religious element is still present. So one of the things, you know, one of the obvious things that happened in the last 10 or 15 years was that the religious center, the sort of individualistic part of American life, shifted towards the kind of secular but spiritual end of the spectrum on a bunch of sort of issues related to personal morality. So with same-sex marriage and homosexuality being the chief example, but you can sort of run through a range of issues if you just sit down with opinion polls and sort of look at what the average American thinks about everything from premarital sex to sort of transgenderism to same-sex marriage, obviously, and more issues. You can see a kind of shift where sort of the individualism that had already extended to encompass certain areas of life extended to encompass even more. And in that shift, the sort of traditionalist flank of American religion was left increasingly isolated and left in a position where it seemed plausible that on a lot of issues related to religious liberty and the kind of sort of church-state litigation that occasionally gets talked about at Yale Law School, you would have a kind of large-scale alliance of the sort of supernaturalist but individualist center and the spiritual but non-religious left against this sort of traditionalist coalition. And that led a lot of traditionalists to a kind of paranoia and anxiety about looming marginalization and persecution and so on. But then one of the interesting things is that, of course, what can easily happen in this kind of fluid landscape is that you know, one pole or the other, when it seems to be empowered, can then overreach. And the reality of that, this sort of individualistic center, is that it is still, it still practices religious faith or connects to religious faith in many cases through sort of traditionalist institutions. And in fact, the big traditional institutions are sort of strung out across the fault line between actual traditionalism and the individualistic center. So you have, you know, the sort of scope and expanse of American Catholicism encompasses not only people who are, you know, should be described as Catholic traditionalists, but a whole range of, you know, every kind of persuasion of Roman Catholics. And something similar is true of evangelicalism. You know, you have sort of the sort of non-denominational Protestant portion of the evangelical church is much more individualistic than the sort of hardcore Calvinist portion of evangelicalism. So in both cases, and in many others, the institutions of American religion exist sort of in this traditionalist to sort of Osteen and Oprah center. And that means that, you know, as that center moves in a more sort of secular spiritual direction, those institutions get weaker. But it also means that when there's a sense that the sort of secular spiritual wing is overreaching, people will say, oh, you know, I don't agree with my church on all these issues, but I still have a kind of attachment to it, and I don't want to see it, you know, sort of ground underfoot by arrogant liberal elites in Washington, D.C. or something. So you can get a dynamic where people who are not, you know, I mean, to take a sort of specific political point, Catholics who do not agree with the church's teaching on contraception or even abortion might nonetheless be annoyed by the Obama administration's conflict with Catholic bishops and conservative Catholics over these issues, because they have a sort of baseline affection for Catholicism. It's the place where they practice their more individualistic than Catholicism is supposed to be form of religious faith. And so when there's a sense that sort of the secular wing is overreaching, you can have a kind of pendulum swing back of people in this sort of supernaturalist center saying, well, you know, I don't agree with my church on gay marriage or contraception or anything else anymore, but I don't want to see it sort of pressured and taxed and fined and sort of pushed to the margins of American life, because I still feel like I'm encountering God when I go to church there. Or my, you know, my brother or my uncle or my son is encountering God when they go to church there, while I go on Christmas and Easter, but I still kind of like it and am fond of it. So you have this sense in which that center acts as a kind of, you know, it acts as a kind of break on momentum swings to one side or the other. And, you know, something similar happened 10 or 15 years ago, where the more traditionalist wing seemed to be more ascendant politically in the administration of George W. Bush, and at a certain point, its ascendance ultimately seemed to alienate a lot of Americans who were religious but not on the religious right, and who began increasingly defining themselves as liberals in order to define themselves against what they saw as the excesses of the religious right. So things can swing back and forth, and I think a lot of what happens in the religious theater of the American culture wars is basically determined by what, you know, what the sort of supernaturalist individualists in the middle think one way or the other, and how much residual affection they have for these sort of traditional institutions that they're partially connected to, versus to what extent do they feel pulled towards the sort of project of spiritual but secular liberalism. So that's sort of one way of thinking about how this framework might be useful for understanding the tug of war in the American culture wars. And it's also useful, perhaps, for thinking about sort of different possible religious futures. And I'll just, you know, sort of offer, I guess, three quick scenarios that we can get into a discussion. Because on the one hand, the persistence of this kind of supernaturalist center means that traditional religious institutions, traditional religious ideas, are not necessarily as down and out as they might seem in a particular moment. You know, where you can, you know, if you just look at the data on the decline of religious affiliation, the rise of people who don't connect to any religious institution, you would say, well, you know, maybe American secularization is taking on this unstoppable momentum, and we'll all end up where Sweden is or was 10 or 15 years ago. And that might be true, but it's also the case that you have this very large population in American life that is susceptible and amenable to what seem to a lot of people in the elite like the most ridiculous aspects of religion, right? The idea, again, that God might intervene personally in your life, that a miracle might be possible for you, that somebody could be resurrected from the dead. You know, these kind of things that in the secular but spiritual circles seem like the ridiculous part of religious belief, the most improbable part, don't actually seem that improbable to lots of people who have drifted away from traditional religion for other reasons. And so there is, in a sense, this sort of permanent, perhaps shrinking, but still substantial mission field out there for traditionalist religious institutions to sort of cultivate in their quest for a kind of revival. So it's hard. What's harder to imagine is traditionalism sort of leapfrogging that middle and reconverting the elite. It's easier, at least on the level of sort of what people already believe, to imagine the traditionalists saying, okay, well, you know, you've sort of lost your faith in the authority of our scripture, our magisterium, or what have you, but you're still open to the possibility that God intervenes in human history, that he's intervening right now. And if you can get over that hurdle, it does seem at least possible to imagine at some point a kind of renewed traditionalist growth happening in that middle sphere. So you could theoretically imagine a world at some point where the strongest and most resilient of the sort of traditionalist religious bodies begin to make inroads once again in the religious center. At the same time, you could also very easily imagine a continuation of the trend of the last 10 years, in which the election of Donald Trump, in fact, is a kind of brief swing back that creates a further swing, ultimately, towards a more sort of secular spiritual perspective. Because in many ways, you know, the election of Trump, I think, partially reflects people in this middle sort of being a little bit skeptical about liberalism and where it's going, but it also reflects a kind of sort of paranoid style and identitarian style among religious traditionalists, that it's quite possible to imagine it sort of succeeding in electing a few presidents, a few more office holders, and so on, while also further alienating the middle, and especially the younger portions of the middle, from those traditional religious institutions. So you could imagine, and you see this to some extent, I think, in conversations within evangelicalism, which is the portion of the American religious landscape that has bonded most intensely with President Trump. You do have a clear generational divide, where you have younger evangelicals who are saying, well, if this is what your traditional sort of, you know, your sort of high view of scriptural authority and your sort of strong moral pronouncements, if all of that boils down in the end to endorsing Donald Trump because you're afraid of liberalism, then, you know, maybe that sort of traditional structure isn't really all it's cracked up to be, and I should drift further into the land of Osteen and Rob Bell and sort of erstwhile evangelicals and so on. So I think you could very easily imagine a kind of generational backlash against the Trump phenomenon that further weakens the sort of traditionalist portion of American religion and sort of creates a further swing of the center towards the secular spiritual left. And all of these right and left terms are just terms of convenience, since theological views and political views are always imperfect maps. So those are sort of, I think, the two most obvious future scenarios: a kind of resurgent traditionalism finding new converts in that middle, or a kind of further swing after the age of Trump that further isolates traditionalists in their own institutions as the wider culture moves on without them. The sort of more interesting possibility is a kind of leapfrog effect, where, you know, the persistence of religious experience is, I think, one of the underrated reasons for the persistence of religion. And it's not completely impossible. It's, you know, somewhat unlikely, but it's not completely impossible to imagine some sort of intersection of a kind of experiential religion and a kind of intellectual conversion having some effect upon the American elite in ways that we don't necessarily expect. I think in general my description of the sort of secular world's hostility to the idea of sort of the supernatural is true, but it wasn't necessarily true 30 or 40 years ago. If you go back to the 1970s and look at sort of the after effects of the social revolutions of the 60s, it was the American elite that was getting into astrology and, you know, all kinds of sort of weird non-Christian supernatural forms of faith. And, you know, Sally Quinn, the great doyenne of Washington, D.C., has just published a memoir that spends a lot of time talking about how she dabbled in witchcraft in the 1970s and put a lot of hexes on her enemies, and, you know, several of them died. And reviewers have not known quite what to do, with this, because the life of the American elite has sort of moved on from the age when Georgetown hostesses were dabbling in witchcraft and experimenting with tarot cards. That seems very 1975, and in 2017 we just sit and meditate and don't put hexes on our enemies. But I think it's a reminder that these things are not, it's not written in stone that the most educated Americans have to be the most anti-supernaturalist and have to just sort of shunt to one side the possibility of the supernatural erupting into their lives. And in fact, if you go back to the growth of Christianity in the Roman Empire, you know, in certain ways, and this is a totally imperfect parallel, but in certain ways, Christianity in the Roman Empire did a kind of leapfrog effect, where it started out as the religion of sort of marginal Jewish troublemakers. And it sort of leapfrogged the vast pagan middle, paganism being sort of identified with sort of rural rustics and their shrines, and instead converted the upper class, and initially particularly the female upper class in certain ways, while also making inroads among the lower class in cities, slaves, and so on. I'm, you know, doing terrible violence to a very complicated story in order to make it fit in with our circumstances. But at the very least, I think the story of Christianity's growth in the Roman Empire suggests that sort of unexpected sort of demographic coalitions for religious change cannot come into being in ways that we don't expect. When you think about the future of American religious life and the possibility for sort of supernaturally informed, unexpected religious changes, Christians and non-believers alike should not assume that that change would benefit Christianity. You can have sudden religious revivals and swerves and all of these things that seem to come from very different kinds of religious experiences. So I hope that is a sort of, again, as I promised, it's not, I don't have a sort of devastatingly brilliant takeaway on what all this means, but I hope this has been a sort of at least somewhat provocative and illuminating way of looking at our religious divisions and how they shape our politics and how they might change. And we've got 15 minutes left, so I'm just going to take some questions. But thank you very much for listening. Yes.
I was wondering what you think about the role of kind of the rise of secular humanism as affecting especially that first sphere of the spiritual but not religious crowd. If there might also be kind of a shift toward that as opposed to a shift back to the non-Christian type of spirituality.
I mean, I think, so you can correct me if I'm not sort of getting what you're asking right, but my sense is that sort of what we think of as secular humanism is by its nature sort of constantly in search of metaphysical scaffolding in certain ways. And
you, In what way?
Just in the sense that it's a challenge, I'm not gonna say it's an impossibility, but it's a challenge to sort of ground what we tend to think of as humanistic values in a mechanistic Darwin plus nothing account of what human beings are. Mm-hmm. And I think you see this sort of in, you know, a lot of debates about, like, you know, is it possible to have to have a theory of human rights, for instance, that doesn't have a sort of metaphysical, quasi-Jacques Maritainian foundation and so on. And I know Sam Moyne here, who's just started here at Yale, has been engaged in these arguments in a lot of interesting ways. So I guess my, you know, and this is my bias as a Catholic, obviously speaking, but I think that sort of movements that explicitly identify as sort of secular humanist end up reaching for something outside the secular to justify themselves, which does not at all have to be Western monotheism. And I think what I see among people who are secular humanists is a kind of reaching for Eastern spirituality over here, pieces of the social gospel over there, but sort of cobbling together different sort of at least semi-metaphysical ideas in order to make their picture of human beings and human nature make sense. Because you can come up with, you know, you can come up with a Darwinian ethics, you can come up with a sort of purely secular materialistic account of why we should be humanists, but it's always vulnerable to the sort of, you know, what is this actually based on question. And there's a certain style of mind that can sort of go all the way with Richard Rorty and say, well, we're just making an aesthetic choice here, and I have an aesthetic preference for humanism because I read great literature and I, you know, have sympathy for other human beings and so on. I think that appeals to a certain kind of mind, but I think a lot of human minds want something beyond that and want answers to the sort of, you know, the reductio ad Hitler that people always come up with, which is like, well, how does your worldview prove that National Socialism is wrong? It's a sort of boring question, but also a sort of important question that I think keeps sending secular humanism towards different metaphysical conceits. And there's a book by a guy whose name I'm forgetting, who was a dean here, about paganism that came out recently about, sorry that I'm...
Tony Grumman.
Thank you. And my colleague David Brooks wrote a piece about it. But you can see, you know, I mean, the Renaissance humanists did something similar. They were like, well, we'll reach back to humanism, but without the literal belief in the gods and goddesses. And there are a few writers, not just him, who have sort of made versions of that move. I think you can see versions of it in Stephen Greenblatt's books, which are basically saying, you know, let's go back to the rejection of the Middle Ages that animated the Renaissance and so on. So maybe there is something that you could just call sort of liberal paganism that could ground secular humanism. But again, there are sort of unanswered metaphysical questions at the core of it. And that's why I think the utility of pantheism is that it lets you sort of mix some Eastern stuff with some Western paganism in certain ways and get to, like, that's where, you know, Thomas Nagel's critique of Darwinism seemed to be going, basically. He's saying, look, science and philosophy, where they intersect, they point to pantheism. So I wouldn't be surprised if that gained, like, if I weren't a Catholic, I would probably be a pantheist, I think. Like, I think it's much more reasonable than the sort of, you know, reductionist perspective. So I wouldn't be surprised if more reasonable people went in that direction. Sorry, that was a rambling answer. Yes?
You talked a little bit about how the middle reacts to defend the traditionalists against overreaches of the left. I was curious what you perceive as the overreaches of the left during the Obama years. How much of those were substantive and how much of them were stylistic, and how could they play their hand better?
I think it was a little of both. I think it was a speed issue, where, you know, you went in our national conversation about sexual ethics from a world where we were having a debate about same-sex marriage that sort of split the country 50-50 to a world where, you know, sort of transgender rights were just immediately assumed to be closed to debate. Like 6 months after Obergefell was decided. So I think in part there was a backlash in the center to just this feeling of like, well, how did that happen so fast? How did we go from this debate that we were having, where I was pretty much convinced over time by the liberal side of the debate, to a world where if you call Caitlyn Jenner Bruce Jenner, you are a, you know, dead-naming bigot, basically. And so in part I think the middle just reacts to swiftness of change as much as it does to sort of... necessarily substantive appeals. It sort of sees overreach in how fast the side that seems to be in power is moving. But then I also think that, I mean, as I mentioned, I think things like the HHS mandate, which are sort of among liberals sort of conventional wisdom that of course you do something like this, of course you require even religious employers to cover contraception. Like, Obamacare would never have passed if the HHS mandate had been included in the legislation. It would have died in the House because of votes from the last remaining semi-pro-life Midwestern Democrats. And so the fact that sort of in the political sphere that was clearly a controversial issue and something that could have doomed the entire bill, to then pursue it in the bureaucratic sphere was to court a kind of backlash. And I don't think it was, you know, I don't think the HHS mandate was like the determining factor in Trump's victory. There were 17 million determining factors and many that were more important. But I think it was an indicator to a lot of, it was an indicator of the potential for the kind of bureaucratically led Bob Jonesification of conservative religious institutions, that there was a real appetite in elite liberalism for using the levers of government power to sort of bring recalcitrant holdouts to heel. And there really was such an appetite, and there remains such an appetite. And you can think that that appetite is, you know, the height of wisdom and justice and that that's how social progress works, but if just in sort of purely political terms, if you're trying to make change happen without producing sudden backlashes of the kind that have put Donald Trump in the White House, you might want to sort of think a little harder before you make certain kinds of leaps that everyone in your circle thinks are self-evident, but lots of people outside it think are sort of taking us towards a realm where churches lose their tax-exempt status or something. I mean, I think, you know, it's interesting to me as a sort of visitor to and friend of people in the world of liberal legal theory, how many people I think would say, again, in sort of a narrow elite, that it would be fine for conservative churches to lose their tax-exempt status if they are preaching what liberalism considers bigotry from the pulpit. I think that that's an idea with a certain real purchase, again, among people who are not swing voters in the Midwest, but are the kind of people who staff liberal institutions. And again, those, you know, it's a world where elite conversations are not happening without people listening to them. Like, people know what the conversation is all over, and that has sort of effects on how people react to different things in certain ways. I mean, you know, again, like the world of sort of conservative Christians who voted for Trump because of religious liberty is not a huge world, but it's a real world, and it includes a lot of people who are, you know, my good friends who I consider serious people, and so I have a sort of bias towards taking it seriously. Yes?
I'm thinking about certain mainline denominations like the Episcopal Church, Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, the main Presbyterian one, the mainline Protestants, who since the 1970s, or maybe even a little before, have accepted things like same-sex marriage, women's ordination, abortion, contraception, and the substantial decline in numbers of people attending these churches, especially millennials. I mean, these are kind of dying denominations.
Yep.
Would you mind talking about that a little bit more?
Sure. I mean, this is an issue that the traditionalists like to cite, right, and say, look, you know, in the competition between churches, theological liberalism leads inexorably to demographic decline. And there is sociologically some real truth to that. But it's important for the traditionalists to recognize that that's not the same as saying, therefore, our traditionalist churches will someday soon take over the United States, right? Because in fact, what happens in those churches is there are lots and lots of people who agree with the perspectives that those churches take. They just don't go to church.
Right.
But they're still religious in certain ways. They belong in certain ways to this center I'm talking about. So in a certain way, I'm stealing this from somebody, but you know, liberal Christianity, it sort of abolished itself in a weird way. It won this big cultural victory that then meant that because it won the argument, people were so persuaded by the argument that they stopped going to church. And that's a, you know, that's a really crude way of putting it. But it is, I think the challenge for the liberal churches is not that in making those changes, they don't have lots of people who are interested in religion and pray and, you know, believe in the supernatural. They do, who agree with those changes. Those people, there are millions of those people. The question is, how do you persuade those people that they should be involved in the sort of, you know, heavy-duty commitment of going to church on Sunday, which is, in fact, a heavy-duty commitment, especially if you have small children and have to get them there. So I think that's sort of the weird, like, it's both true that there, you know, if you're working in the world of sort of church planting and institution building, the commonly held idea that if we just liberalize, we'll keep the millennials in church is wrong. There's no evidence for that. But that doesn't mean that all the millennials are crypto-traditionalists. It means that the millennials are sort of liberal Christians or semi-Christians in a way that just doesn't induce them to sort of be active and involved in their churches. There are also some sort of secondary things going on, like one reason the mainline declined was because of a divergence. If I had chalk, I'd draw diverging lines, but a divergence in birth rates of evangelical and mainline churches that started in the 1930s. So there's
this introduction of contraception?
With the introduction of contraception, but also sort of, I mean, I think prosperity as much as contraception is a big part of it, that sort of the upper middle class churches had fewer kids. And so that sort of, so there's, again, sometimes conservatives say, well, everybody left the mainline churches in the 70s. And lots of people did leave the mainline churches, but it was also that, you know, the Baptist churches still had people who had, you know, during the baby boom, the Baptist church had families with three or four kids. And the ELCA church had people with two kids. Mm-hmm. And by the 70s and 80s, that was cashing out and so on. And that's a sort of big underlying story just going forward, that there is this sort of permanent birth rate divergence between traditionalists and everybody else. The question is, but then a lot of the traditionalist kids are sort of converted away from traditionalism. So there's a sense in which the traditionalist churches are on a treadmill. You know, you have four kids in order to keep two kids in order to maintain the size of your churches, and the other wings of American religion can sort of rely on, well, you have four kids, and then one of them goes to Yale, and the next thing. There are a lot of different factors. So it's 2 minutes of one, so I should take one more question, and then you guys can start abandoning me.
You referred to what that sort of first category is shopping. And it occurs to me that another word that you might have used would be seeking, and that might sort of put more focus on similarities rather than differences. When I heard shopping, I sort of thought,
it's pejorative, yeah.
Cheap and shallow, yep. and you know, kind it's of associated harsh. With consumer culture. So I wonder if you could say more about that choice, whether it's deliberate, because there seemed to be that framing a couple of times, and it seems to focus, again, more on differences rather than on similarities.
Yeah, and I think focusing on some, I mean, one thing I was trying to do, and of course my, you know, pejorative biases slip in, but was to emphasize that there is still a kind of common ground in American life in terms of an interest in religion that you wouldn't necessarily realize from the way sort of polarization gets talked about and so on. I had my oldest daughter goes to a sort of small p progressive school, and I go to the morning meetings, and it's sort of a, you know, it's a kind of distillation of a certain kind of this, what I'm describing, a sort of secular but spiritual perspective. And, you know, they ask us to do a little directed breathing in a sort of meditative style at the start, but then they're, you know, they have someone come out with a guitar and play play a song for the kids, and the song is often, you know, something that comes from a sort of, you know, the black spiritual tradition or something. Like, there's often a sort of religious element woven into this environment that is sort of, you know, it's very much a sort of secular liberal environment. But what there is there, I think, is a kind of, there's a sort of permanent respect for religion joined to a sense that at its best, religion is a conduit for the pursuit of political justice and a means of sort of centering yourself and being a good person, and that the problem with religion, the reason the secular but spiritual people reject it, is a, you know, one, the absurd dogmas, and two, the rules particularly surrounding sex. So I think that's, so even, and in that sense, the secular but spiritual have a lot in common with the religious middle, right? And the language of shopping or seeking that I use to, for sort of, you know, my kind of people, the college-educated elites, also applies very much to the people in the middle. They're looking for, they're looking for a way of integrating elements of religiosity into their life in a disenchanted age, in order to make sense of the universe and be happy in the day-to-day. And, you know, and so are traditionalists, right? I mean, I and people like me, people in the sort of conservative realm of religious commentary, we spend a lot of time bashing the therapeutic style in American religion, right? Some of you are probably familiar with Rod Dreher's book, The Benedict Option, which leans very heavily on the idea that the core of American religion is what he, borrowing from Christian Smith, calls moralistic therapeutic deism, right? Which is the idea that God is this sort of cosmic butler who's just there when you need him and so on, and it's all about sort of making you a better person and making you a better self and so on. And I think the traditionalist critique of what's wrong with that, which I've made myself, is very powerful. At the same time, you know, even the traditionalists, in a sense, think of religion as therapeutic, in the sense that, you know, true religion is supposed to lead to human flourishing. Now, that human flourishing may take the form of getting roasted over an open fire by, you know, by the people you've gone to convert and so on. I mean, what the traditionalist would say is, you know, you have to have a more capacious definition of human flourishing than just upper middle class life in America. But it's still the case, right, that the traditionalists aren't just saying, you know, religion is supposed to make you suffer and be unhappy. They also are saying that, you know, there is sort of an integrated vision of human person, of sort of human personhood and life and flourishing that, you know, that where how you connect to the divine should lead to flourishing. There aren't these clear, bright lines between my categories, and they all bleed into each other. And the fact that, like, again, Roman Catholicism is basically one big, huge argument that's especially under the current pontiff, spans this whole sort of traditionalist to the middle, and even incorporate some of the secular but spiritual element. I mean, you know, so, and one of my jobs writing about the church is sort of figuring out, well, you know, where are the lines and what are the divisions that actually matter? But it is also just this sort of spectrum that is, yeah, that still offers a lot of potential common ground, even if it is extremely difficult in many cases to actually find it. So, thank you guys so much. I really appreciate it.